where the violence occurred, which is where I lost it. Many of us were weeping. It was impossible to be with them at these places and hear them say, "This was where it got really bad," without weeping. But after the ceremony, even an old agnostic like myself felt cleansed. It is the power of ritual within us that is so important. And how wonderful to see George, Olivia and Danny receiving blessings. We felt very uplifted by their bravery, their honesty, and their grace in dealing with such an experience. George would not survive another year. He died of cancer in November 2001. Impossible to believe he wasn't weakened by the attack. The first I realized he wasn't going to live was when I spoke to him on the phone in Switzerland. He'd finished an album. "What are you doing now?" I asked. "I'm working on the liner notes," he said. "But if I don't finish them, then you will." What did he just say? "If I don't finish them?" I went to visit him a few times as he was dying in a house in L.A., owned by Paul McCartney, to whom he had already said a tearful farewell. Jim Keltner told me that when I walked into the room, it was the first time he saw George perk up and smile. We talked, though interrupted by his terrible hacking coughs. Tanya and Lily had flown to Chicago for Thanksgiving, but I wanted to stay close to George. When they returned, we made a little package of food to take over to the house. We were 20 minutes too late. We were met at the door by our security friend, Gavin De Becker. "He's just gone," said Gavin simply. The sight of him, peacefully laid out in saffron robes with a bindi on his forehead, was too much. I stepped forward to kiss him goodbye and totally lost it. I held him, my shoulders shaking with grief. We were all weeping. "Come on," said Danny. "Dad wouldn't have wanted this." His funeral was a simple affair at the Hindu temple on Sunset, with a familiar incense from Friar Park, a large photo of George, and his recordings of the chants of Ravi Shankar. Afterwards, friends gathered at the nearby home of Mo Austin, where I tastelessly said, "I'd like to thank Marlborough, without whom we wouldn't all be here today." Later the next year, I was proud to eulogize George at the Hollywood Bowl. When they told me they were going to induct my friend George Harrison into the Hollywood Bowl Hall of Fame, posthumously, my first thought was, "I bet he won't show up." Because, unlike some others, he really wasn't into honors. He was one of those odd people who believe that life is somehow more important than show business, which I know is a heresy here in Hollywood, and I'm sorry to bring it up here in the very bowel of Hollywood, but I can hear his voice saying, "Oh, very nice, very useful, a posthumous award. Where am I supposed to put it? What's next for me, then? A posthumous Grammy? An ex-knighthood? An afterlife achievement award?" I think he would prefer to be inducted posthumously, because he loved comedians, poor, sick, sad, deranged, lovable puppies that we are, because they, like him, had the ability to say the wrong thing at the right time, which is what we call humour. He put Monty Python on here at the Hollywood Bowl, and he paid for the movie The Life of Brian because he wanted to see it. His life was filled with laughter, and even his death was filled with laughter. In the hospital, he asked the nurses to put fish and chips in his IV. The doctor, thinking he was delusional, said to his son, "Don't worry, we have a medical name for this condition." "Yes," said Danny, "humour." And I'm particularly sorry Danny isn't here tonight, because I wanted to introduce him by saying, "Here comes the sun." But sadly, that opportunity for a truly bad joke has gone. What made George special, apart from his being the best guitarist in the Beatles, was what he did with his life after they achieved everything. He realized that this fame business was, and I'll use the technical philosophical term here, complete bullshit. And he turned to find beauty and truth and meaning in life, and more extraordinarily, found it. This is from his book, I Me Mine. The thing that most people are struggling for is fame or fortune or wealth or position. And really, none of that is important, because in the end, death will take it all away. So you spend your life struggling for something which is, in effect, a waste of time. I mean, I don't want to be lying there as I'm dying thinking, "Oh shit, I forgot to put the cat out." And he wasn't. He passed away here in L.A. with beauty and dignity, surrounded by people he loved. Because he had an extraordinary capacity for friendship, people loved him all over the planet. George was, in fact, a moral philosopher. His life was all about a search for truth and preparing himself for death, which is a bit weird for someone in rock and roll. They're not supposed to be that smart. They're supposed to be out there looking for Sharon, not the meaning of life. He was a gardener. He grew beauty in everything he did, in his life, in his music, in his marriage, and as a father. I was on an island somewhere when a man came up to him and said, "George Harrison, oh my God, what are you doing here?" And he said, "Well, everyone's got to be somewhere." Well, alas, he isn't here. But we are, and that's the point. This isn't for him, this is for us, because we want to honour him. We want to remember him. We want to say, "Thanks, George, for being, and we really miss you." And this is the big drag about posthumous awards. There's no one to give them to. So I'm going to give it to the love of his life, his dark, sweet lady, dear, wonderful Olivia Harrison, who is with us here tonight. Liv, you truly know what it is to be without him. Thank you, Hollywood Bowl. You do good to honour him. A year later, on the anniversary of his death, Olivia and Danny mounted a wonderful memorial concert for George at the Royal Albert Hall in London. Never have I seen so many grown men in tears. George had the capacity to reach in and take your heart. Eric Clapton had organised the music with Danny, and they had rehearsed for 3 weeks with some of the greats, like Tom Petty and Jeff Lynne, and of course Paul and Ringo. They all played George songs, a very nice touch. Olivia had asked me to ask the Pythons to sing Piggies. But I said, "Liv, we can't. We're not musicians. That's not really what we do." I persuaded her, and bless her forever for this, to let us come on instead as waiters and sing Sit on My Face. It was such wonderful bad taste, and a laugh is exactly what you need for sadness. At the end, we all slowly turned round and bowed to the huge photo of George behind us, revealing to the entire audience our ancient bare posteriors. I'm so proud of that moment. You often hear the statement, "It's what he would have wanted," but never, I think, was it more appropriate. He would have loved the sheer tasteless joy of what we did. Although we were without John, we hadn't been on stage together in London for almost 40 years. And in the dark, before the lights came up, the crowd somehow sensed we were there and went crazy. I felt the hairs on my neck stand up. When we did the Lumberjack song, Tom Hanks came on quietly as a Mountie in George's role. There were many tears backstage during that concert. I had to resort to the bathroom on several occasions, but Paul, in particular, was wonderfully comforting, like a big brother. "Come here, you need a hug." At the end, when we all stood quietly on stage while Joe Brown sang simply and unforgettably to his ukulele, "I'll See You in My Dreams," and rose petals began to fall from the ceiling of the Royal Albert Hall, I think everyone lost it. I can still hardly remember that moment without tears. We all knew what we'd lost. Chapter 25, Brightside on Broadway. John Dupre and I did a second North American concert tour in 2003. The point of a Greedy Bastard tour is that having taken 22 people round America, the next time, in order to make money, you take only yourself. The next time, I took only 2 other performers and a band, but William Morris still made more than me. Eddie Izzard and Billy Connolly were encouraging me to do more stand-up, more improv, more talking about myself, so I did. We went all the way across North America on a rock and roll tour bus, travelling 15,000 miles in 3 months, playing at beautiful old theatres. The Greedy Bastard Diary is my daily account of this journey. In Vancouver, as the holidays approached, I tried out a new song John and I had written called Fuck Christmas. It was like throwing a hand grenade into the crowd. The audience response almost blew us off stage. Each line killed, especially the end. Go tell the elves to fuck themselves, it's Christmas time again. Apparently, we could still write funny songs. Just as well, because John and I were working on an exciting new project. In the 90s, I'd worked on a Python CD-ROM game of the Holy Grail. If it could be a game, I wondered, why couldn't it become a musical? Grail was perfect for a musical. Every sketch seemed to demand a song. It appeared to have all the elements of a great comic stage show, a mock-heroic pastiche of Wagnerian grandeur, with bickering knights riding around on imaginary horses. But would the Pythons ever give us permission? Only one way to find out. I wrote a play adapting the 98 characters in the movie to a more manageable 8, and then John and I recorded half a dozen songs and sent them off to the guys. Amazingly, they were all intrigued by the idea. They loved the song that goes like this, and wonderfully, they said yes. Spamalot was born. I'd had some previous experience of Broadway in the late 90s when Garth Drabinsky, the Canadian producer of Ragtime, asked me to write the book for Seussical, a musical based on the Dr. Seuss books. I was shamefully ignorant of Seuss, so I read everything, including some interesting biographies, and set to work writing a treatment for Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty, brilliant songwriters who had had a huge hit with Ragtime. I decided Horton should be the central story because I loved the tiny Who world, desperately seeking help. Inside that plot, I crammed as many references to the other stories as I could, eventually delivering a heavily illustrated treatment in the summer of 1998. Lynn and Stephen loved it and set to work writing the score, which they did remarkably quickly, and it was soon filled with brilliant songs. But then the fat lady sang. Garth Drabinsky sold his company to Mike Ovitz, the former CAA agent, who soon found a second set of books with the real figures, and now faced an uphill task of trying to turn round a debt-ridden theatrical company. Garth himself fled from the feds to Canada, where he would eventually do some time. But the experience set me on the path to Broadway and my own Holy Grail. I was supposed to write the book for Seussical, but once Garth departed, new management came in with a different idea. I did play the role of the Cat in the Hat for the Broadway Investors tryout, and Lynn and Stephen wrote me a special song, How Lucky You Are, which took place in total chaos as the set fell apart. But at no stage was I tempted to swap my wife, child and home in L.A. for 8 shows a week on Broadway, and I turned down repeated offers to play the Cat. Seussical taught me a lot about musical theatre and what it takes to make things work, from having good producers to getting the book right and how to advance the plot through the music and dance, a lesson choreographer Casey Nicolau would repeatedly drum into me on Spamalot. Now I had more experience of Broadway, and I also had a script, a title, and the rights for the Holy Grail. What next? My lawyer and good friend Tom Hoberman suggested I approach Bill Haber, another founding father of CAA, who was venturing onto Broadway. It took me 20 minutes to sell the idea to Bill in my L.A. home, where I'd laid out the Holy Grail dolls and some of the tons of merchandise from that movie. I played him a couple of the songs that John Dupre and I had demoed and handed him the script. He was in before he was out the door. "What about a workshop?" I said. "We won't need a workshop," he said. "This stuff has been playing successfully for 30 years. We'll go straight into rehearsal." "Wow. Who would you like to direct?" he asked. "I'd like Mike Nichols," I said. "Who wouldn't?" he agreed, "but it takes Mike ages to respond. I know him, and he loves the music of John and me. All right, I'll send it to him." Mike called me 3 days later. "Yes, yes, yes," he said. From the beginning, Mike was determined to have Always Look on the Bright Side of Life in Spamalot. He'd come to the Greedy Bastard tour in New York and seen how the audience responded to the song, joining in and singing along happily. He wanted Spamalot to end that way too. For him, it would simply be the finale, but Casey and I put the whole song into the play while Mike was away in California, opening Closer. I couldn't get Act Two to work, and I felt we needed something familiar near the beginning, something the audience could relax to, a little moment for Patsy, where he tries to cheer up the despairing King Arthur. So, always look on the bright side of life, which started off in Brian, eventually ended up in Grail and on Broadway. Spamalot changed my life. I thought the play would be funny, but I had no idea it would be so successful and so well received. Mike Nichols was, of course, the key. Not only did he reassure the other Pythons that here was someone responsible enough to be left in charge of their baby, but as he was both a comedian and a fantastic director, the play would be in the very best of hands. I had met Mike back in 1975 at a party at Paul Simon's, where I talked to a stranger for 2 hours and found him the funniest and most interesting man I'd ever met, and we yakked away until he finally left. "Who was that?" I said when he'd gone. People looked at me like I was nuts. "That was Mike Nichols." "Oh, duh." Ironically, as Mike would always say, when I was at college, I was a big fan of his records with Elaine May, but I'd never seen either of them live or on television, so I simply hadn't recognized him. One of the great delights of life from that moment on was lunch or dinner or theatre or anything at all with Mike. Once in St. Paul de Vence, we passed an art gallery selling a sculpture by Salvador Dali. Mike stopped and went in. "How much is that Dali in the window?" He loved being funny and outrageous. He was late one day for rehearsal and was apologizing profusely to me. The traffic was horrendous. The whole of the Upper East Side was Yidlock. He would look so happy with that lovely smile when I cracked up. He was always fantastically generous to his writer. I've never been so encouraged by anyone. He wouldn't let anything pass. He'd badger you until you'd finally send him an email with a new proposal he liked, and he would simply respond, "Perfect." Mike's most brilliant decision was picking Casey Nicolaw, the choreographer. It was Casey's first Broadway show, helming the Terpsichore, as Variety might say, and it was an utterly inspired choice. His choreography, a perfect balance between sweet and silly, and his own amazing calmness and leadership, inspired the whole company. As for the actors, many of them came to Mike. David Hyde Pierce called and insisted on being in it. Hank Azaria said he'd known his line since he was 12. I'd always wanted Tim Curry for King Arthur, and when Mike heard him read the part at my house, so did he. The Lady of the Lake was the hardest part to cast. I created the character as an African-American diva, and later she often was, but Mike said one day, "There's someone I want you to look at." So we all assembled in the Schubert Theatre, and Sada Ramirez came on stage and sang a Sondheim piece. She blew us away. She was so powerful, so passionate, and so goddamn sexy. Every man in the room was smitten. Oh, yes, Mike. Next year, she won the Tony. Mike brought a high seriousness to Spamalot. He insisted the actors always take it seriously. If you don't take it seriously, why should the audience? Sitting behind him, watching him give notes, was a masterclass in directing. I had almost 5 years of it. He told them to listen to what the others were saying. Often he would have them lie on the ground and just say the lines, no acting, no emphasis. If they found a new laugh or a new piece of shtick, and kept it for another performance, he would make them take it out. "You must kill your babies," was his refrain. He insisted they believe in their characters. Often he was quite severe. Some actors he insulted. A very small number he made cry. He would not let anything through. His rule in productions was, no assholes. We had one who thought it funny to slap another actor. Mike fired him at lunch. One day, he was being very severe about a scene. "You must make them real." "But Mike," I said, "you're talking about the knights who say ni." He laughed, but he was right. I think he'd noticed something about Python. We always believed in everything we did. After all, the Minister of Silly Walks is only funny if he believes he really is a minister with hard choices to make on a declining budget. If for 1 second he doesn't, then the sketch falls flat. Something rather special was happening in the large mirrored rehearsal room on 42nd Street. The great news had come in before we even started rehearsals that we had sold out the entire run of previews in Chicago. I kept writing to the other Pythons, "Don't miss this," but they did, except for John, who came to visit. He walked in just as they were rehearsing his song, Knights of the Round Table, and he was totally delighted. We hugged, and it was really sweet to see him. The cast saw him too, and perked up, and performed the life out of the number. There were tears in our eyes as we sat side by side and watched them, thinking how amazing it was to sit here 30 years later and watch people doing this. John was affable, charming, and complimentary. It was a joy to see him back in the studio as he recorded the lines with Tim Curry. He was hilarious. His God has a wonderful testiness about him. "Of course it's a good idea! I'm fucking God, you idiot!" Mike suggested the billing should read, "And John Cleese as God." Email. Subject: rehearsals. From Eric Idle to the Pythons. "I just thought you should all know that Spamalot is not only progressing well, it is a positive blast. I sit in a warm rehearsal room on 42nd Street, watching pretty young women in leotards, bending, bouncing and stretching. And the show is pretty good too. In fact, I sit next to Mike with a big silly grin on my face and tears in my eyes. I can't explain exactly the appeal. It's something to do with compounding the silliness. John C. came in the other day just as they were rehearsing the Knights of the Round Table song he wrote with Graham all those years ago, and he just beamed and glowed. He came to play God, and won. His voice is now in the show. So the reason I'm writing is to encourage you to drop by the process if you can. I think you'll find it marvellous and uplifting, and even moderately arousing. The script, particularly Act Two, was changing daily, but has now locked down into a better shape, and everything seems to flow, though often into unexpected quarters. You'll see what I mean. I'll keep you updated in any case. We have another 4 weeks in New York, and then move to the theatre in Chicago, where we just announced an extra week of performances. Tim Curry, Hank Azaria, and David Hyde Pierce and all couldn't be funnier. Or nicer. Mike says he hasn't been so happy since The Graduate. Hugs to all, E. Subject: 2 weeks of rehearsal. From Terry Jones to Eric Idle. Dear L, ah, the magic of the theatre. Sounds wonderful, warm and inviting and arousing. It's the girls in leotards bending and stretching that really convinces me that the whole thing is going to be a thundering success. I wish I could get over, but on the other hand, if Bush gets in tomorrow, I think I'll give the US a miss for another 4 years. I hear the extra week is sold out already. Can this be true? Fingers crossed all over my tense, yet still young body. Lots of love, Terry. I responded, "Say it ain't so, Tal. You can't let the bastards win, and you really must see Spamalot. It's your creation, too. Would a Hitler victory have stopped you going to Berlin for the Ludo finals? Of course not. Where's the man I once saw conducting a German band while stripping in front of Nazis at a beer festival in Munich?" I agree. Anger would be a correct response, but I remain foolishly optimistic. Miss you, E. There were three blizzards in Chicago during the previews, and the cast bonded. We all loved each other, and there were many parties and much dancing. Mike had only one major concern. I had written a lyric that contained the hook, "You won't succeed on Broadway if you don't have any Jews." He was worried about how this would be received by an audience. "Well, we'll just have to try it," I said. "Only way to find out." So at the opening preview in Chicago, the show took off like a rocket. The audience was so into it. "He is not dead yet" made them yell with happiness. "The song that goes like this" killed. "Find Your Grail" was electrifying. We were all smiles at the intermission. Act Two opens with Brightside, and they actually whistled along. "Now for it," said Mike next to me, as what he insisted on calling the Jew song approached. David Hyde Pierce sang, clearly enunciating, "You won't succeed on Broadway if you don't have any Jews." There was a moment of stunned silence. The audience rocked back in their seats, mouths open, and then instantly rocked forward again, screaming with laughter. At the end of the number, they applauded and applauded and applauded. Some people even stood. It was a mammoth hit. "Well, I guess that's okay then," said Mike, beaming that wonderful beam. By the time we moved to Broadway, thanks to reviews and word of mouth from Chicago, we had a huge box office advance. We opened on St. Patrick's Day. All the Pythons attended. There was a glittering audience. Mike had pulled in quite a crowd. Mountains of opening night gifts flooded into my hotel room, overlooking 44th Street. My wife, daughter, and sister-in-law Joyce were all getting dolled up, resplendent in a new charcoal cashmere coat from my exceptionally generous producer, Bill Haber. I walked to the theater from the back entrance of my hotel, down 45th Street, and across Times Square, thinking to myself, I must remember this and how it feels. I was elegantly dressed in a brand new Issey Miyake tux, with an outrageous day-glow shirt, with a fake tie in luminescent green. Smart, but silly. I was aware that the picture we were about to take with the pythons would be the one used of us for the next 6 years, or forever, if we never met again. It had been 7 years since the last photograph of us together at the Aspen Comedy Festival. We only seemed to get bigger. Schubert Alley was closed off with security people who recognized me and let me through. Backstage there were happy laughing people from Fiddler on the Roof, and Harvey Fierstein was there for the Gypsy Robe presentation, a Broadway opening night tradition that Harvey, in his wonderfully precise voice, explained to me. They handed the traditional robe to the youngest of our chorus ladies. Then they hugged us and wished us good luck and left. And Casey said, "All right, everybody, just one chorus of Knights of the Round Table." And right there they all snapped into the closing song and dance routine. This was so sensible and so centering and such a smart thing to do that I admired Casey and his brilliance all over again. We were bonded and centered and ready. Nothing much for an author to do except hang around and wait for the PR folks to deliver me up to the media. I was taken out and grilled in front of the theatre for the world press, then back along the alley into the Booth Theatre where the pythons were being held downstairs. They seemed to be at ease and looking forward to seeing the show, sipping drinks in the mirrored bar, and I hugged them all. John was looking particularly distinguished. We were all anxious to get on with it, and soon the relatives were shepherded away, and we were left waiting on the stairs. It all felt strangely familiar. John pushed Mike around like a schoolboy. "You still can't keep your hands off him, can you?" I said. And we were once again that odd group of strange men backstage waiting to go on. We were led out to the front of the Schubert to face the electrical storm of the cameras, amidst cheering and screaming from the crowd across the street. The pythons were all gracious and affectionate, and then we disgorged into the celebrity-packed theatre. Whoopi Goldberg said hello. Lorne Michaels smiled. I spied Barbara Walters and Mike Wallace from 60 Minutes, and there was a general air of anticipation. Soon the lights dimmed, the overture played to laughter, and we were underway with Finland. I thought the show went really well, especially for an opening night. Mike hated the audience, and the cast thought they were down. But the people there experienced the most joyous and wondrous opening night in a long time. At the end, the cheers were deafening, and Tim Curry very kindly called the author up on stage. I got a huge ovation, and then Mike, and then Casey, and then John Dupre came up too. We all took a bow, and then I said I must ask up a group from Britain without whom we wouldn't all be here today. John, Paul, George, and Ringo. And then we pull the pythons up on stage. I was looking at my daughter's face in the front row and winking at her, and just feeling this warmth and enormous love for all the pythons together again. Finally, we cued the music, and we all sang Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, until the curtain came down and there was a great deal of hugging. Mike Palin was in tears. John, too, had a tear in his eye and kissed me and said, "Well done." I told everybody that the pythons coming made the evening for me. And it was true. It was all fantastic, really. The ratfuck, Mike's ubiquitous term for any black tie event with rubber chicken, was held at Roseland and was loud and big and meaty, with roast beef and Yorkshire pudding and a huge castle built out of Spam cans with a cartoon Holy Grail in the centre of it. I was interviewed and photographed and then was caught near the door by a series of well-wishers. Nice people crowded around me. Irene and Buck Henry were glowing with enthusiasm. Tom Hoberman was in tears. A lawyer crying. Elliot Brown said, "Do you know how rare this is? In 20 years of going to the theatre, only 3 times could he remember an opening like this." I was happy to see Roger Waters there, and glad he loved it, as he was one of the original investors in the movie. Coco Schwab came to get me and dragged me over to a grinning David Bowie, standing with Lou Reed and the adorable Iman. Both musicians thought Sada Ramirez a gold mine and had the idea to make money from her. I told them they were too late. Also, there was Eddie Izzard, Python fan extraordinaire, who had flown into New York from Scandinavia for one night only to attend our opening on Broadway and then immediately returned to his tour in Sweden. The next day, I walked into Sardi's, and the producers were all having lunch, and they stood and applauded me. By then, the box office was going nuts. The reviews were apparently sensational, though I stuck to my guns and didn't read them. We'd done over $900,000 in the morning. By 2 p.m., we'd passed the $1 million mark in a single day, and by the evening show, we were already over $2 million and making Broadway history. So, not just a great show, not just great reviews, great box office too. We had pulled it off, the grand slam. Did I learn anything? Certainly. First, Mike's law, only work with the best. Second, Mike's second law, never give up. Third, always work with Mike. Chapter 26, The Tony Fairy. One morning in the 80s, when I lived in St. John's Wood, I received a large package with an invitation which said in big gold letters, "Congratulations, Eric Idle, Tony Award nominee. You, Eric Idle, have been nominated for a Tony Award. We would like to invite you to New York for the Tony Award ceremony, and we are very happy to inform you that you have been nominated for Best Female Performer on Broadway." I have to admit that this was a shock. I certainly hadn't expected it, but I am a polite man, and I wrote back. "I'm so thrilled to receive this nomination. It is one of the greatest honors of my career. It is particularly thrilling for me because not only have I never appeared on Broadway, I'm not even a female. I would be delighted to attend your award ceremony. Would you like me to wear a frock?" There was a series of embarrassed phone calls, and sadly, it turned out it wasn't for me at all. It was for Cheetah Rivera. Well, it's a mistake anyone could make. Eric Idle, Cheetah Rivera. I very much enjoyed the confusion, and for a long time I counted that nomination as one of the most unlikely near achievements of my career. So it was something of a surprise when I actually did receive two real Tony nominations for Best Book and Best Lyrics in a Musical Play on Broadway for Spamalot. I'd never actually seen a Tony show before I attended Radio City Music Hall for the 2005 Tony Awards. Most of the audience of all sexes were drooling over Hugh Jackman, the host. Spamalot had been nominated for 13 Tonys and had already lost 6 when I spotted Mike Nichols heading urgently up the aisle toward me. "They're going to stiff us," he said. "You have to think of something to say." In a previous life, I wrote ad-libs for David Frost, so I didn't panic. David would say, "I need a line to get me over to the junkies," and I'd scribble away, and live on air, David would say the line I'd given him, exactly as if he had just thought it up. "I'll have a go," I said, wondering if the junkie line could be of any use. Mike returned glumly to his seat, and I was so busy racking my brains for something amusing to say that wouldn't sound bitter and twisted, but incredibly mature and suitably grateful for being ignored and passed over completely, that I barely noticed when I personally lost the next award for Best Book of a Musical. My lovely wife, looking adorable in Harry Winston diamond earrings, on loan for the night, gave my hand an encouraging squeeze. Advised by the virtually irresistible Hugh Jackman that this would be a good time, Tanya then exited to the bathroom, during what was promised as a long commercial break, only to be replaced in her seat by a mature-looking lady in a large and very bizarre hat, which resembled a ginger tomcat, squatting on her head. It is axiomatic that there must be no empty seats visible at TV award shows, and highly dressed extras are employed to deftly slide into the gaps when people pop out for a smoke or a pee. Of course, this was the very moment the cameras singled out me and my wife for our close-up, as I bravely lost for Best Lyrics in a Musical. I was so busy trying not to laugh at this strange woman smiling proudly by my side, giggling at the knowledge that people all over America were going, "Whatever happened to Tanya?" and "Has he gone mad, taking up with a weird cat woman?" that I didn't even have time to feel disappointed. We had, after all, already been winners at several major Broadway award ceremonies, and Mike had picked up a variety of oddly shaped statuettes and made a series of increasingly funny speeches. My favourite, when once again his name was announced as the winner, was watching him walk up slowly, look genuinely puzzled at the audience, and say sadly, "I miss failure." On Tony night, the pigeons of irony were coming home to roost, as we continued to miss out on best choreography, best score, best actors, best sets, best lighting, best costumes, best new shoes, etc., etc. Finally, the Tony fairy relented, and the utterly deserving Sara Ramirez headed up the aisle to accept her award for best performance by a featured actress in a musical, thanking us, her parents, and Claritin. And then, of course, Mike's nightmare was over, as he won yet another Tony for Best Director. I crumpled up my pathetic half-written one-liners in relief. But fate had one more surprise in store for us. After a very long and occasionally interesting evening, the inestimable Hugh Jackman read out the name of Best Musical of 2005. And incredibly, it was Monty Python's Spamalot. Wow! Who would have thunk it? Our cast of knights and wenches spilled out onto Hugh Jackman, whooping and hollering, and the auditorium was filled with smiling producers hurriedly heading for the stage. I beat them to it by a good yard. Mike gave me a proud hug, and I barely restrained myself from kissing Hugh Jackman. There would be time for that later. We danced and partied in the brilliant way our company had perfected. It was a wonderful evening. I, who had been sober for 5 years, had just the one glass of champagne to celebrate, and that one glass went on for 12 years, as they do. I'm back on the wagon now, much to the disgust of some of my friends, especially in France. I'm far less fun, but I get more done, and at my age, the less you fall over, the better. Gravity, once your friend, becomes your enemy. Sorry, people, you can say break a leg, but it'll have to remain metaphorical. I broke a leg last year, and I hadn't even had a drink. It cost so much that I seriously considered marrying my surgeon. He was cute, too. I guess it might have been the painkillers. Once, after ankle surgery, they gave me a morphine button, which I could just press to top up. I knew I was doing too much when I became aware that I thought Regis was the funniest, smartest, and wittiest man on TV. Wait, could it be the morphine? At the end of the night, Tanya, like Cinderella, had to return the Lona jewels to Harry Winston. A long line of limos outside their 58th Street side entrance meant they'd had a busy night. At the Tonys, discreet security guards had hovered everywhere. Discreet, if you consider 7-foot linebackers clearly packing heat, a form of discretion. But for heaven's sake, they were lending actors jewellery. So, as we pulled up, Tanya reluctantly kissed goodnight to the glittering diamond earrings and the gorgeous diamond and amethyst ring, and I took them inside and dropped them in front of a man in shirt sleeves. He had a snub-nosed 38 sitting on the desk in front of him, in case anyone changed their minds. I changed my mind the next day and snuck back to Harry Winston and bought the diamond and amethyst ring for Tanya. I mean, how often do you win a Tony? Chapter 27. Diva Las Vegas. It's 8 o'clock in the morning and already stinking hot in Las Vegas. Not just hot, it's blindingly bright. There is simply too much sunshine bouncing off the golden walls of the Wynn, blown by the strong wind shuffling across the desert, which lifts the awnings on the striped pavilions and ruffles the tassels and snaps the umbrellas. This is the only time you can be alone in Vegas. One or two early risers sit in the white ranks of loungers by the pool. The waiters chatter over the endless heartbeat thump of the disco. The gardeners spray water on the Provençal shrubbery. Even the crickets are chirruping, though I am suspicious and see they have been piped in. There are tiny little speakers everywhere. Yes, the devil is in the details. There is half a forest of huge pines, impressively green on the hillside, hauled in and tastefully replanted amongst the artificial grass, fake rocks, and carefully constructed waterfalls. I think I prefer the fake to the real. Hardly surprising, I am in show business, which is all about faking the real. The beauty of ancient places is accidental. The ugliness of Vegas is planned. Yet to stand in front of the phony Doge's Palace at 11 and hear the chimes of Big Ben from London, the pealing of the bells from Paris, and the explosion of a volcanic waterfall is to experience something unintended. A random universe created by a thousand monkeys. It makes you ask, why am I here? The answer is Spamalot. Spamalot was the first time in my life I experienced big money, and I liked it. That wonderful summer of having a hit on Broadway, Bill Haber, our producer, invited me and Tanya to stay at his chateau in the Loire Valley. He showed me to our suite. There, on the mantelpiece, was a check for $500,000. To an English guy brought up poor, that was incredible. Next year, he invited us again. I took our bags up and came back downstairs. Bill, I said, there's no check. Thanks to Steve Wynn booking the show into Las Vegas, we'd made our money back in record time. Only 18% of Broadway shows ever do that. What F. Scott Fitzgerald said of American Lives is definitely true of Vegas. There are no second acts. Partly this is because they want you back in the casino, but mainly it's because they want you back in the casino. In fact, with our low ticket prices, $49, $69 and $89 bucks, I've figured out that you will actually save money if you go and spend 90 minutes in Spamalot, even on the cheapest slots. And if you sleep during the show, you can save on a room. I'm a little concerned about how our show will play out here in the desert. So as part of my research, I visited all the major attractions. Nothing quite matched the intensity of Jubilee, which gripped me with its thrilling story of 150 bare-breasted ladies seducing Samson and causing the Titanic to sink. Sometimes the plot was hard to follow. As the huge ship went down on stage, firing off rockets of distress, I knew just how it felt. To me, the most interesting part of the evening was watching a show where the girls start nude and gradually put on more clothing. An oddly effective technique. One thing for sure, you cannot out-Vegas Vegas. There's simply no parodying this. There is no over-the-top, only over-the-topless. At the world-famous Crazy Horse, all the girls have short blonde wigs, perfect derrières, and genuine French names like Fifi and Suki. They remind me of what the 70s was all about. Light shows and shagging. But this show, too, is a little thin on plot. And clothing. The rest of the entertainment is all French-Canadian, from Céline to the many cirques. Monty Python was a flying circus, but does that qualify us as a cirque? We have no acrobats, no contortionists, and only a few French people farting in our general direction. How will the nipple-hungry Nevadans take our show? At the press launch, I say, I'm missing my wife so much here in Vegas that last night I paid for a woman to come up to my room and ignore me. Steve Wynn says he's been trying to finish Broadway in Las Vegas, and what better way than to put on Spamalot? He had recently put his elbow through his own Picasso in front of a small crowd of stunned guests. As a gag, I tried to persuade him now to put his elbow through a fake painting. "It'll kill," I said. "No way," said Steve. "Bad enough I'm known as the Inspector Clouseau of the art world." Instead, John O'Hurley from Seinfeld, who was here to play golf and King Arthur in that order, comes on stage. Together, we do a tango. Why? Because neither of us could do the Paso Doble. And, of course, we brought on our beautiful showgirls, wearing only white lingerie. Why? Do you need to ask? I announced that, as an added attraction, some of our shows will be topless, but only in John O'Hurley's part. Next day, we are in a rehearsal room in the less salubrious side of Vegas, amongst the bail bonds and the pawn shops, the last place you see before the desert. Our modern studios are pleasant, and the cast is confident as they read my edited version for Mike Nichols and Casey Nicolau. It's not bad, but we caucus thoughtfully in a conference room. On Broadway, the play was 50 minutes, then a nice intermission, and then 60 minutes of Act Two. Now, it is 90 minutes straight through, and that's a completely different dramatic shape. There's work to be done. It's not that we are long, but with a 90-minute shape, you have to feel the driving force of the plot. It must never feel like a sketch show. We roll up our sleeves and set to work. I have a wonderful feeling of nostalgia. It's like 2 years ago when we were on 42nd Street. Ah, happy days. Mike gives a masterclass. He talks to the actors for about 50 minutes, but in that talk he says everything they will ever need to know about drama. He's spectacular, not just about truth-telling in acting or storytelling, or about the shape and types of scene, but how to ask, what is this like? Who am I being like? What does this remind me of? He ends by reminding them not to be funny. Just say the words. Don't act. Meanwhile, I am cutting and pruning and trimming, and there are glum faces as I remove favourite bits. Then I bring in my secret weapon, Terry Gilliam. I confess to the cast that what I had told them about all the other pythons being dead is not true. They are thrilled to meet the legendary Gilliam, who has brought down more financial institutions than Enron. Even he is bowled over by the Grail Theatre and the new Python Hall that leads up to it. Large cut-out iconic figures of silly walks and colonels and naughty vicars decorate the entrance, and there is a plethora of Gilliam art. Terry says he's going home to persuade Michael Palin to come for the opening. Ironically, Michael has announced he's staying home because he's writing a travel book. John Cleese is scheduled to attend, but then he plays God, and we know they both move in mysterious ways. Sadly, Terry Jones can't make it. He is apparently wrestling with chemo. I rather hoped he would be here wrestling with Kino. Will Spamalot succeed? Who knows? Dare I say it's a crapshoot. We have, by Vegas standards, a huge advance, but the word of mouth will be everything. If we make them laugh, we'll have a shot. If not, well, we have the North American tour, we have Broadway, we have London, and soon Australia, and I shall just have to get used to not having dinner with billionaires again. The first preview went great. In fact, it took ages to clear the theatre afterwards, as they were lining up to buy merchandise. Killer rabbits, coconuts, and flying cows. Even the wind folk were impressed. On the third night of previews, we had a major glitch. Our elevator failed, and instead of the Lady of the Lake and her Laker girls emerging from a pond in their skimpy fronds, nothing happened. King Arthur stood gesturing to an empty stage. "She's a bit late," said John O'Hurley, exiting. "I'd better see where she is." Galahad and Patsy and Mrs. Bedivere looked alarmed. "Me too," they said, and they all went off, leaving an empty stage. Great. Nice improv, people. From below, we could hear the Lady of the Lake singing away with all the chorus girls, but no one emerged. Backstage, they had forgotten to build stairs from the basement to the stage level, and now the onstage lift was jammed. The stage was empty, the audience was growing restless, and nobody came on to explain anything. Oh, dear. We were going to have to stop. Some deep show-off instinct kicked in, and I found myself rushing down through the audience and up onto the stage. The place went wild, the easiest standing ovation I ever had. "This is what, technically, in theatrical terms, we call a fuck-up," I said. "A huge helicopter was supposed to..." Oh, no, that was another show. I ad-libbed for about 10 minutes, thinking how Eddie Izzard would be proud of me doing improvisational stand-up in front of 1,600 people. Luckily, the glitch ended before I did, and I escaped back into the audience, and the show continued. Opening on my 64th birthday, March the 29th, 2007, Spamalot would run in Las Vegas at the Wynn for 16 months. And when we closed, I said we were some of the few people ever to leave the city with money in our pockets. Chapter 28. Brightside Gets Brighter. In 2005, John Dupre and I won a Grammy for Best Musical Show Album for Spamalot. On Thanksgiving Day that year, our New York cast sang Always Look on the Bright Side of Life on a float all the way down Broadway in the Macy's Parade. Soon after, we opened a highly successful North American tour in Boston. Spamalot would eventually open in London, Germany, Spain, France, Sweden, Holland, Norway, South Korea, Australia, and even Japan, where I sang Brightside in Japanese on Japanese TV. Jinsei lakuni eki yo-yo. Well, that's how they wrote it out for me phonetically. I attended many opening nights in cities I'd never yet visited. Barcelona, Madrid, Oslo, Stockholm, Malmö, Copenhagen, and Budapest, as well as a delightfully sexy production in Paris and a brilliant mad version in Mexico City, and always ended up on stage singing with the cast. John Dupre and I put Brightside into our next show as well, a comic oratorio called Not the Messiah, He's a Very Naughty Boy, based on the life of Brian, which we premiered in Toronto at the Luminato Festival, conducted by my cousin, Peter Ungen, the principal conductor of the Toronto Symphony Orchestra. Peter had encouraged me to find something two improbable cousins could do together. When I suggested Not the Messiah, he loved it. Christopher Siever, our wonderful first Galahad, came up from our Broadway company to play Brian. He would later play Galahad again for us in London. We did a further two performances at Carrimore with the St. Luke's Orchestra and Chorus at the bottom of Martha Stewart's garden. The oratorio went down so well that later in the year we added a second act, and John Dupre conducted his own brilliant score on a tour of New Zealand and Australia, including two performances at the Sydney Opera House. A year later, we went on a US tour to Houston and Wolf Trap, an outdoor venue near Washington with a 7,000-seat theatre, culminating in two glorious nights at the Hollywood Bowl before 24,000 people, where John wrote some special encore music for Fireworks based on our Galaxy song. We finally filmed Not the Messiah for DVD at the Royal Albert Hall in 2009, with Michael Palin, Terry Jones, Terry Gilliam, Neil Innes, and Carol Cleveland, to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Monty Python. I was asked to sing Brightside again for Prince Charles's 60th birthday concert in November 2008. This was a charity show for the Prince's Trust at the New Wimbledon Theatre, with many funny people, including Joan Rivers and Robin Williams. I decided to play a gag similar to the one I had pulled on his mother. I was closing the show, and John Cleese introduced the English National Ballet, warning the audience it might be rather tedious. A beautiful Brazilian ballerina danced the dying swan, surrounded by a bevy of young girls in tutus from the English National Ballet School. As the swan expired, I popped up from the middle of the corps de ballet in a tutu and said, "Cheer up, ducks! You know what they say? Some things in life are bad." Once again, we totally surprised the audience, and they all laughed and happily sang along as we filled the stage. Unfortunately, as this was the closing number and there were to be drinks afterwards, I hadn't realised I would be trapped on stage to meet Prince Charles while still dressed in a tutu. If you want to be really laughed at by people, try wearing a tutu to a royal cocktail party. I'd met Prince Charles at Billy Connolly's Highland Home, where we would gather with comedians like Robin Williams, Steve Martin, and Eddie Izzard. The royal heir loves comedians. One night, he came to dinner, and everybody was being a bit polite as we sat down, and nobody said anything. There was an awkward pause as we sat around the huge dining table. "Billy," I said eventually, "is there anything to eat?" Well, that kicked off Robin, and the evening became uproarious. Later on, wiping tears from his eyes, Prince Charles said to me, "Eric, why don't you become my jester?" Everyone looked at me. No pressure. "Why would I want a fucking awful job like that?" I said. He laughed his head off. In another century, he could have laughed my head off, but I guess that's the job of the jester anyway, to put you back in the moment. Secretly, of course, I was very flattered. Perhaps my favourite time singing Brightside was in June 2010 at the American Film Institute tribute to Mike Nichols. It was a glittering Hollywood occasion, and again I was to close the show. I decided to come on dressed as Emma Thompson from Mike's superb production of Angels in America, in a wig, a white frock, and huge angel wings. At the sound check, I tried out my costume and decided to surprise Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, who were on stage rehearsing Mrs. Robinson. "Hello, chaps," I said, behind them. They turned around, saw me in full drag, and couldn't continue. On the show, an announcer said, "And now, to close the show, here is Oprah." And I came out, dressed as Emma, and began to sing. I left the stage descending on a host of stars, including Steven Spielberg, David Geffen, and Oprah herself. I remember thinking, I like my life, as I searched for Emma Thompson. As I approached her, she fell off her seat. Mike had tears in his eyes as I ended up singing the final chorus to him. At least I didn't have to stay dressed up like that at the after party. Ah, dear Mike, I was proud to be invited to speak in his honour at a 75th birthday dinner thrown for him at David Geffen's remarkable art-filled house in Bel Air, and attended by Diane Sawyer, Mike's wife, gracious and beautiful as ever, as well as the Hankses, Larry Ellison, David Mamet, the list went on. When it was my turn to speak, I stood and pulled a piece of paper out of my pocket and began seriously. Is there any greater pleasure in life than having your face licked while ejaculating into the body of a younger woman? Oh, I'm sorry, that was for something else. I threw the paper away and produced another from my pocket. I began again. Is there any greater pleasure in life than having dinner with Mike Nichols? Well, yes, obviously, there is one, but apart from that, when I asked my wife what it was about Mike Nichols that was so special, she said, "Oh, just hurry up and come." I added a few more low comments before concluding, "Here's a little poem I wrote for you, Mike. Love makes the world go round, love conquers all. True love will never forget. The world loves a lover, love's all you need, and I am Marie Antoinette." I was asked to sing my song once again, to my surprise, at the closing ceremony of the London 2012 Olympic Games. My friend Patrick Woodruff, who lights up the stars from Dylan to the Stones, said, "You have to do it, Eric, it's a classic." And so, one August night in 2012, I found myself standing by one of the six wide entrances that dotted the arena. The turf was damp beneath my feet. I could see Russell Brand on top of a garishly painted double-decker bus, accompanied by brightly coloured Beatle figures. The Spice Girls passed me, standing on top of London taxis. "Fucking hell, that was scary," said Posh. "Time to go," said an assistant, and I made my way in darkness past hundreds of extras held back by tape. The enormous crowd was painted in coloured light. Patrick would be given an OBE for his incredible work. I made my way towards the wooden scaffolding, holding up the impromptu stage that had arisen in the last 16 hours in the centre of the 90,000-seat arena, filled with the sweat and memories of thousands of athletes from around the world. I'd been hiding in a small holding area, somewhere under the massive new concrete stadium, in a caged-off space with a fridge, a tiny truckle bed, and a kettle. I was reading Camus' L'Étranger in French all day to prevent any anxious English thoughts intruding. Pretentious? Moi? Actually, it was very calming. I had been there since 10 in the morning, waiting for the chance to rehearse my number. It never came. Tonight, live on worldwide television, would be the first time I'd climbed out onto that stage. No point in panicking. Back to the Algerian beach with Brother Albert. I popped my head out briefly as the show started. Timothy Spall came by as Churchill. "That was terrifying," he said. I retired to my French. Still 40 minutes to go. Suddenly, it's time. I'm dressed in what is supposed to be a cannoneer's outfit. A body double of me is to be fired out of a cannon in a deliberate misfire that will land him in a hole centre stage. It will be me who emerges. I'm led out amongst hordes of changing dancers. They glance only briefly at me. I smile and nod. I do this every day, right? Somewhere, high above in a box, are my wife, son, daughter, and cousin Nigel. Don't think of them, it's just another show. I cross the damp grass of the stadium, reaching the mineshaft entrance, where I'm greeted by friendly Cockney voices.